The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Cloakrooms to the left, drinks are inside for you.
We're here at the Oxo Tower in London, the River Thames stretching out beneath us, to catch up with the winner of the 2015 Guardian First Book Award. A prize which searches for the year's most exciting debut in any genre, from fiction to polemic, and from poetry to the short story. This year's judges include the poet Kai Miller, the broadcaster Emily Maitlis, the historian Tom Holland, and the critic Alex Clark. But the prize is also powered by the collective intelligence of reading groups all around Britain. Let's see what they're made of this year's shortlist.
My vote would go for The Shore by Sarah Taylor. I just thought it was a lovely bringing together of lots of different characters in a quite surreal setting that really caught the imagination.
We were quite surprised because the shortlist didn't quite match our own judgments. It caused quite a lot of debate between us as a group.
We firmly came down and The Fisherman was tied for first place.
Yes.
Seemed to be a sort of original voice. It was a sort of compelling read.
My personal favourite was The Shore by Sarah Taylor. I thought it was just so beautifully constructed with all the back and forth and time. Absolutely loved it.
We've all come down from Manchester, yeah. Mine was probably Man v Nature. I really enjoyed it because I like the way that Diane Cook sort of utilised short story as a way of going through a lot of different concepts and sort of visiting different elements with a similar theme that sort of flowed throughout.
I'd be really happy if Grief is the Thing with Feathers wins. I found it absolutely unbearably moving at points. Yeah, really sad, lovely, so well written. I really hope that wins.
But now it's time to find out the winner of the Guardian First Book Award 2015. And here comes Guardian editor Kath Viner.
I absolutely love the First Book Award. It's fantastic to be there at the beginning of things. It's a brilliant long list this year. It was a brilliant shortlist, and it's a brilliant winner. The winner of the Guardian First Book Award 2015 is Physical by Andrew McMillan.
Thank you very much. Poetry never wins these kind of things, does it? Which is the first time ever. There's no burden then. In terms of people I need to thank, most importantly, Robin Robertson, who took a chance on an unknown young lad from South Yorkshire who insisted that he didn't want to use any punctuation. And Robin was all right with that. And if the book is any good at all, it's only because of his kind of patience and his love and his dedication. And so I thank Robin very much for that. And I said, and I'll say this because I promised that I would, I said that if I won, I'd dedicate it to my partner, who I wrote a book kind of about people who left or people who didn't stay. And I met someone who gave me the confidence to believe that someone might want to stay and that someone might want to be with me. And so I dedicate this win to Benjamin, who I love very much.
According to the First Book Award judge, Alex Clark, the panel was bewitched by the sensual power of Macmillan's poetry.
It immediately spoke of an incredibly confident voice, but not confident in a way that made you think it was a writer who thought he'd answered all the questions. It was somebody who was setting questions to himself and to the reader and trying to solve them in various poetic ways.
That's what you're looking for in the first book, the voice straight away.
You want something, I think, where you feel that something's at stake, where you feel somebody really has pushed themselves to the limit, where they've put everything into their first book, but not so much that there's not going to be anything left over for future books.
What kind of poetry is Physical? How would you describe the collection?
Well, without being an incredible expert in prosody, I think it felt to me very varied. There were very tender poems, there were very harsh and unflinching poems, in a way. There was humour on the page. There were all sorts of examinations of very, very intimate life, those moments of real kind of personal jeopardy and emotion.
Some of it's pretty raunchy, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I guess that would be a word. Yeah, some of it is pretty pretty straightforward on the kind of physical business of life, as the collection title demonstrates.
There's a real bravery in the way that he's exposed these very raw, these very intimate moments on the page. How does he do that without turning into being sentimental or shocking or mawkish?
Well, I think it's always got those sort of moments of cutaway. There are always those moments where there's a poem that's set up kind of brilliantly and then it reveals itself to be something more. Then it really sort of opens up and takes you to a different place. And of course, that's always what you want things to do. You don't want the end of a poem to leave you with the idea of all the knots neatly tied.
Poetry often struggles to find a readership in a crowded market. But according to Waterstone's Stuart Broom, the first Book Award reading groups were full of praise for physical.
I think many of the reading groups, the readers in those five groups, opened the book thinking, this is not for me, this is not a person who necessarily is from my background or speaks with my experience. But over the pages, as the poems accumulate, it does what brilliant writing does in terms of it speaks to you from across a great emotional distance, and I think it resonated very clearly with readers of diverse ages, backgrounds, tastes. And I think what really struck me when I was hearing the feedback from the reading groups was that many of the readers had said this collection settled in their minds and it was the book that they had thought most about afterwards and had wanted to go back to. And that, I think, is the proof of the pudding is there, that it's a book that you haven't discarded, that actually lives with you, settles, and you want to return to. And that, I thought, was just that little spark of excitement about a debut that people would come back to, find fresh things in.
It's very firmly anchored in gay culture. Does Macmillan manage to reach out and make something more broadly about contemporary culture?
I think he does. It's a very specific piece of work, and it feels as well very autobiographical. He seems quite unabashed about describing its autobiographical content, and that's always your worry about first-time writers when they transcribe stuff directly onto the page without any mediation. But the form of the poems and the wit, it's a collection that's really transformed by its wit and its verbal energy. So I think it really does reach out beyond its very specific concerns in terms of like a gay male framework, out beyond that. And when you have a voice, a poetic voice speaking to you, that's something very powerful.
What kind of thing can a prize like this do for a debut collection of poetry in terms of sales?
I think sales-wise, poetry indisputably sells in smaller volumes. It is a quieter medium, but it is in many ways a more passionate medium as well. The people who feel really committed to poetry are absolutely passionate about it. And so the fact that you can diffuse a bit of that passion outwards from people who are already committed poetry readers will do amazing things for its sales. He has a big publisher, and it's been published well, it's got a beautiful cover, it looks great. So it's got all of the things alongside a prize to speed it on its way. I think it will do very well.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
It was a chance encounter that brought Macmillan to editor Robin Robertson's attention.
I met him at the T.S. Eliot Prize a few years ago, and I was introduced to him as a poet, and I said, well, what are you writing and what have you got? And he said, well, I'm working towards a collection. I said, well, I'll send it in. And, you know, I've had that conversation thousands of times, and I will have thousands more. And he sent it in, and, you know, business of being an editor is very interesting because you spend your whole time disappointing people and making yourself miserable, really. But then every now and again, and it really is very seldom, a book comes along, a manuscript comes along that is absolutely thrilling. And you can just see
This is so fresh, this is so exciting, this is so new, and it gives you faith that, you know, you're in the right job, you know, you can actually have some fun. And so I took him on, and we worked together. And it's been a very happy, harmonious arrangement, and I'm so thrilled that he's been recognised by The Guardian.
You even let him publish a whole collection without a comma or a full stop.
I know, that went very against all my Scottish Presbyterian principles of grammar. I could see what he was doing, and, you know, he may not be allowed to do that again, but, you know, this is his first book.
Just after the announcement, Andrew McMillan was still getting used to becoming the first poet to win the Guardian First Book Award in its 17-year history.
But what just happened? Like, so we were stood there, and I had in my head a list of people that were going to win. And Max Porter's book is astonishing, so I thought, right, it's going to be Max's, it's going to be The Fisherman that was shortlisted for Booker, and then we went down and I was the last one. So I thought, well, being shortlisted is the prize for a poet, because only one other poet has ever been shortlisted. And then it, what has just happened? But there are so many better books than mine, is the thing. But genuinely, for a poetry collection to be shortlisted for this award is, that's the you know, the falafel, as they say in Barnsley.
So we take it that you're pleased then?
But, like, yeah, because, so, I wrote this collection of poetry not really believing that anyone would read it, because it's about me, and it's about my exes, and it's about my life, and it's very confessional. And so you write this, and the only way to write a book like that is to believe that no one will ever read it.
Would you read us a bit then?
This is not quite. Each of us having loved each of us in some earlier room of our lives, there was the awkward intimacy which only comes from having grasped between our lips the truest part of one another. And now the task of the bedroom rehung and altered. Pick your euphemistic metaphor, stubbled sandpaper or the shoulder crowning weight of lifting a settee. Arms we touched seeming to grow towards our hands as though our hands were light. The mirror watching ourselves undress.
The men here seem very anxious, very worried about themselves. Is that what it's like to be a man in this beginning of the 21st century?
I mean, the fascinating thing about writing this book was, as a gay man, I have a certain perspective, but then it seemed to me that growing up in South Yorkshire in the 21st century, you get the crisis of masculinity that happens in the 80s and 90s when industry kind of shuts down, and what does it mean to then be a man if you don't have a job? And then, but that somehow progressed to a kind of hyper-masculinity where you see these chaps in the gym who are very kind of bulked and very kind of hyper-masculine. Yet they're still as insecure as we are about what it means to be a man, what it means to be a provider to a family. Can they provide to a family? What does that mean? And the collection isn't necessarily a homosexual collection, but it wrestles with those ideas of how do you be a man in a world that is constantly emasculating? So it occurred to me that to understand kind of masculinity in the 21st century, you want to watch heterosexual men attempt to interact with each other in a gym. And it's fascinating, that kind of awkwardness of like, oh, what can I do? Like, that, it's just fascinating. And so this is the men are weeping in the gym. The men are weeping in the gym, using the hand dryer to cover their sobs. Their hearts have grown too big for their chests. Their chests have grown too big for their shirts. They are dressed like kids who have forgotten their games kit. They are crying in the toilet, and because they have built themselves as statues, this must mean that God has entered them. They are wringing their faces like sweat towels in the sink. Their veins are about to burst their banks. They are flooding out of themselves onto the tiles. They have turned water into protein shakes. They have got too close to the mirrors. They have got too close to the glass. And now they are laying in the broken pools of their own faces. the lines of them, the decline press, the bicep curl, waiting, staring straight ahead, swearing that the wetness on their cheeks is perspiration, that the words they mutter as they lift are meaningless, that they feel nothing when the muscle tears itself from itself, that they don't hear the thousands of tiny fracturings needed to build something stronger.
The physical is often seen as one half of a double act. There's, you know, the physical or the mental, the physical and the spiritual. What's the thing that's missing here?
The thing that's missing is almost, I think, the religious. And for me, the physical aspect that comes across in the book, because I'm an atheist, so I don't believe in a kind of higher being or a god, but to me, the kind of the spirituality or the contact with physicality, that's the religious experience, because it transcends the everyday and it takes you to somewhere new. And that's all I want from these poems, really, that you might read them and you might view your partner or the person you meet on the street or your wife or your husband. You look at them slightly differently, maybe. And I like that transcendence, that it's not just the body, but the body is the divine being I like.
One of the things that you might look at slightly differently, having read this collection, is the work of the poet Tom Gunn. What's your relationship with that body of work?
So I came out to my parents when I was 16, and that same night my parents walked into my room and said, I think you should read this. And by this they meant the collected works of Tom Gunn. And I realised that's a ludicrously kind of privileged kind of story to have. But what I found in Tom Gunn was not necessarily the subject matter. I grew up in Barnsley, who grew up, you know, he was writing about San Francisco, but just that you could write about longing, you could write about physicality, you could write about love. And I took kind of permission from that. And for a lot of the time, I was just writing kind of bad parodies or pastiches of Tom Gunn. Maybe I still am. But what I took from him was permission to say what the way that I live my life, what I do, is worthy of poetry. So a lot of the book is based around people who I'd been with or exes, and I suddenly realised putting together the book that the people who it hadn't quite worked out with deserved a poem as well. The people who, if the die fell slightly differently, think, oh, it'd be them that I was with. And so this is for them, called A Gift. A gift for the ones I never touched, for the ones who wanted to watch films, who wanted to talk, who wanted silence and said I talked too much. For the one I saw weeks after, laughing. For the ones who served me coffee and didn't recognise my hands. For the optimistic ones who write their names on toilet walls. The ones I never called. For the ones I called who didn't answer. Who left our love suspended from the ceiling hooks of that meat market city. For the ones who left and settled down, the ones who wanted knowledge, were curious, who gained something from each encounter, used each other, who took what they needed, for everyone they hurt, who felt burned out, the ones who didn't realise everyone was burning, the ones who never slept, who died nightly, the ones who said they'd kill for it. For all of them, a gift. We were young. We only had our bodies.
Poems, many of them, are deeply rooted in gay culture. Are you hoping that they can reach out beyond there and find a wider audience as well?
I mean, this is a really hard question, because On one level, my reaction to that is Sharon Olds or Simon Armitage was never called a heterosexual poet, so they're just a poet. But I'm a gay poet, so I'm writing about kind of homosexual relationships.
And you'd describe yourself as a gay poet, would you?
Well, this is the kind of troubling thing, because I, on a personal level, wouldn't, because what I think I write is confessional poetry, and I've only ever slept with men or fallen in love with men. And so my poetry naturally leans towards men. But
what I recognise as a white, cisgendered man is that I have an incredible privilege over a lot of other communities who need an identity to cling to. And that identity can often be powerful for them. And so I think oftentimes that label of a queer poet or a gay poet can be really powerful. It's one that I've resisted, but it's one that I want to give permission to other people to use, I guess.
You said that you started writing these not imagining anyone would ever want to read them. But did you ever have an idea in your head that you should modify what you were saying for an audience out there? You should try and shock them, or you should try and pander to them, or make things easy to understand?
I mean, that shocking thing is really interesting. The kind of poetry audience is oftentimes, because of money, for monetary reasons, retired middle class, because they're the only people that can afford to buy tickets to a literature festival or something like that. And so oftentimes after reading, you get, that was shocking, or that was new. And I just always thought, well, it wasn't really. I read a review of a book the other day, and it said, what this book is showing is post-sincerity. And I was terrified by the idea that we could be post-sincerity, because in this world where everything's terrifying and everything's kind of uncalculable and the Wi-Fi is kind of buzzing around our heads, all I thought that poetry could do is bear honest witness, truthfully and plainly, to what's happening, and not be post-sincerity, but to utterly sincere and try and connect with people. And that's all I wanted this book to do.
There's a breathtaking intimacy to some of the material you use. Did it take you a while to find the courage, the bravery, to put it out there?
Yes. So, like, my first pamphlet, the chap who we won't name said, kind of like, that it was too teenager-y, it was too kind of... It was just too emotive, that people wouldn't connect to what a young lad wanted to say. And so I took that on board, and I thought, no, he's right, that chap. And so I started writing really ironic, really kind of postmodern experimental stuff. And it did all right. I got pamphlets published, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. And I wanted to just publish something that was straightforward, that was direct. And the stuff that I love, Sharon Olds, Mark Doty, Jeff Hattersley, is down the line and direct. And I wanted to... The only reason any of us ever write is because we read stuff that we then want to emulate, I guess. And so I wanted to be in that lineage. I never want to be post-sincere. I want to be sincere.
Is this sincerity, this openness, part of the reason why there's no punctuation? Are the poems coming, as it were, naked to the reader?
I hope so. And the great thing about Robin was, the first thing he said was, I can't believe I'm publishing a book with no punctuation. But here we go. And we kind of went along with it. But as uncontrolled as it looks, there are 3 spaces for a comma, 6 spaces for a full stop, 12 spaces where there might be a longer pause, but it's still controlled. But all I thought was, we don't talk to each other in punctuation. So we don't say, and I will now tell you, comma, an anecdote about, that we just kind of talk, and sometimes there are longer pauses, sometimes it's awkward, sometimes it runs on together. And all I wanted to do in a book is to present, if we were sat in a pub together, this book is how I might tell you what happened. And that's important to me, I think.
Except that it's not quite, is it? Because it's so carefully arranged. And that you allow, that many of the poems allow themselves to build towards some sort of lyrical finish, some sort of flight of a glimpse of a wider space.
Yeah.
Do you think that each poem has to earn that right to be poetical?
I think it does, and I think it comes from my first apprenticeship before Tom Gunn was Philip Larkin. And if you read Larkin, his kind of great thing is these kind of final lines that open up to something else. And really it's about balance. And so, because I teach undergraduate creative writing, and so what you end up saying to students all the time is, you can have a great end line that's really poetic, but you need to balance that with something really plain. Or you can have a plain end line that needs to be balanced with something very poetic. So it's about balance. But I always thought, I go to poetry when I'm scared, when I don't know how to live my life, and I want poetry to tell me how I'm meant to deal with the world as it is in the 21st century, with all its kind of terrifying manifestations. And I want that Larkin-esque final line that goes, what will survive of us is love, or that Elizabeth Bishop line that goes, somebody loves us all. I want that final clarity that goes, oh, okay, I'm all right. Everything's going to be okay. And that's, I'm reaching for that, I guess, in poetry.
The collection is bookended by a dedication at the beginning to your parents and thanks at the end to Stefan and to Gerard for letting me write what we had. What do you think are the responsibilities a poet who wants to explore the personal, as you do, has to the people around them?
I think it's an incredibly difficult terrain to navigate. I think my parents is one thing because I dedicated the book to them because every opportunity I've had comes from my recognition that I was in a privileged position to grow up surrounded by poetry. And so I read a lot of poetry. But to the exes, Gerard and Stefan, half of me thinks if they date a poet, they know what they're signing up for. And so I don't apologise for a lot of the book. I don't think anyone comes across bad in the book. Like, if anything, it's me. People are like, well, why? Why do you think, you know? But all I wanted to do was take everything that happened to me and try and make it redeemable, try and say, well, it's worthy of poetry. It's not bad. It's worthy of literature.
So this is a book of, as you say, of departures, of exes, the people who didn't stay. What should we be looking forward to next?
Well, this is the thing, because I'm in a really nice long-term relationship, which isn't great for writing. But what I was kind of half thinking about was, this book is very much about a male gaze on men. Not homosexual, but how men interact with other men. And what I'm fascinated about now is how gay men particularly interact with women and what it means to be a gay icon and why certain people are gay icons but not others. And so the next collection, I think, will deal with that, but also childhood as well, but less of the promiscuous sex because I'm not having any.
The winner of the 2015 Guardian First Book Award, Andrew McMillan. We'll be back in the studio next week for more literary discussion. You can find us online or install us on your smartphone by sparking up your favourite podcast app and searching for Guardian Books Podcast. Until then, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Susanna Tresillian, thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.